We knew where we stood. We were with send it to Rhodesia, send it to South Africa, send it to Egypt. But for goodness sake, well, that's a little bit far away. But in the end, Canada's the only place that they could possibly put it in. Now, they didn't convince us at that time at the staff college, but by 1938 and 1939, when Rob came to Ottawa, came to Canada.
They put the seed in your mind then, is what I'm saying.
Oh, we'd fought the battle a dozen times in the staff college, but we then had to agree that there was no other place, because we had one overriding factor of all factors why it had to come to Canada. Is that they, in the War I, the British Isles were very nearly starved out, because the sea power by itself alone couldn't guarantee the channel, that one channel would be kept open. So it took air power and sea power and the whole works to keep one great tunnel, if you like, or one ship across that Atlantic carrying the supplies from the North America. Food, ammunition,
everything. Well, that was the concern, of course, it was ammunition.
But he said you would never have enough air power and enough sea power, battleships or anything else, to set up one across the... You had to have one across the Atlantic for food alone, food and military supplies. Mm-hmm. Now, that pipeline had to be big enough and good enough to take the whole works. And if we were smart enough to have one good pipeline that would work, if we lost any one of the pipelines, we'd lose the war. And as simple as that. And that's the way it worked in World War I, because we'd look at the children that were starving in the United Kingdom, rickets and everything else, in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no way we had to agree to be school teachers.
Okay. Well, let's jump ahead. We'll come back to the question, but let's jump ahead then to 1937. Now, Rob comes out still convinced that Canada is the place to go.
Oh, well, Mackenzie came.
Now, this is what I'm trying to get at. Now, when Rob came out, you were around and you were privy to all what was going on, and I was wondering if you could describe Rob's visit in 37.
I'll tell you, leading up to it, What we had learned at the staff college to get that civil base, and I think it's more important because it comes first in the right order. The flying club served a tremendous purpose. A tremendous purpose. First of all, they enabled us to get the training we had some 34 flying clubs by the time the war broke out in 39, right across Canada.
Mm-hmm.
But the last six or seven were just pretty well on paper and just getting going. But the others, some of them were going very well. For example, in Hamilton had a very good school, and we had a good flying club and a good auxiliary squadron who were actually flying and functioning. And the two that were set up, one in Toronto, number 10 in Toronto, and number 11 in Hamilton. There were two in Montreal, one in municipal squadrons.
Halifax.
Yes, and then right across the west and out to Calgary and a good one in Vancouver and so on. Now, in addition to those were what we call auxiliary squadrons, but they're really militia squadrons. Mm-hmm. They worked by a week in their businesses and so on. Whatever little bit of pay they got, they put into their mess and their mess funds to keep it running as a squadron. Now, the flying clubs fed those squadrons. We, in setting up the flying clubs and working very close to civil aviation, we'd had all that way, all our work in the civil aviation, we could fit together, no problem. And the flying clubs took them in and gave them their first elementary training. But before you could set up a flying club, you had to train instructors up to certain standards. Who could do it? Well, the Air Force were the only people that could do it. There were no other flying schools. The same with civil aviation. There's no civil aviation at all. And then when they did start some civil aviation, they would have a crash. There would be crashes. There were. We had to put down our tools and go over the weekends and hold a court of inquiry and find out. I had One summer I had about all my best weekends were ruined by chasing around troubles in the civil aviation, but you did it. You did your job.
So what you're saying, if I'm correct then, is that to secure that civilian base, to have them behind you, you took the time and effort and passed on this viewpoint to your junior officers.
Well, they just fell into the teams, and you picked them in to work in your team. So there was no exactly passing it on. It was just the thing to do. They could see what
it was. The kind of thing you kept on doing.
Well, right up to where, but I want to get it very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
The great number of these now, in funds, Mackenzie King and the government would vote money to buy an aircraft, for the flying club, because that was votes. No problem. And all, and he was a big boy, a big daddy, by putting money into flying clubs. So I had no problem in feeding the flying clubs the director training. I saw to it that that's where it went, because that's what I could get. And what little money we did get voted for us, he would put it into the Treasury Board and sit there until the year ended up, and then it would revert to the Treasury. He wouldn't spend it. The House would of Commons would definitely say, vote, we would get so many new aircraft. We didn't get them.
Yeah.
Because he would argue that maybe they weren't the right type and maybe we'd know better the next year or something else. And year after year, we were still back on the old aircraft moon and in the effort.
And you didn't have the money to use either.
But there was no doubt about it that we were, and Rob was doing exactly the same thing to some extent. In England, they were doing the same thing in England with their flying clubs and their civil schools. So we were simply following out the same, roughly adapting it to our conditions.
In Germany, they were using flying clubs to get around the Treaty of Versailles.
Well, they sent their, some of their, they had their glider clubs.
Yeah, the
glider clubs. And then they put a lot of their training in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, over in the Switzerland. I made the trip around to Germany in 1930 and saw some of their training in Switzerland, down on the Bodensee, Lake Constance, and that, and also the Zeppelin headquarters, Friedrichshafen.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there and looked them over in 1930. Spent a week there.
Back to Rockwood, sir. So, what I'm getting at is, when were you converted that Canada should be the, as it turned out, the BCATP?
Yeah.
When were you converted? Now, did that come in 37 with Rob's?
Well, yes, about 1937. We hammered that out 1,000 times with Rob. Friendly. Never.
No, understandably.
I adored him, liked him, and we got on very well. But he said, he would say, okay, where would you put it? And how would you function? And how would you get the... How are you going to keep the pipeline there? Have a pipeline around Africa, another one through the Mediterranean, another one across the North Atlantic. Why, he said, it's ridiculous. If we keep one main pipeline across the North Atlantic and one to Australia, out to the east and far east, and keep, after Singapore,
mm-hmm.
we only had the one from Australia, and that was only due to the Americans going in and keeping the Pacific open. After Pearl Harbor.
But you became convinced with Rob's visit.
Rob and his team.
And his team.
Yes.
You mentioned that when Rob was out, he had an interview with Mackenzie King.
Well, this is private. This wasn't in the House of Commons.
No.
But Rob was there to expound what he was up to. And he didn't realize what Mackenzie King was like. So Mackenzie King drew himself up, and so Rob said when he came back, he was shaking all over, and he came to my office, and he told me what happened, that Mackenzie King told him, well, you'd better wait, and for propounding that idea of putting a training plan in Canada, in 1937 this was,
mm-hmm.
until they were sure, until he was sure, Mackenzie King was sure. Which side Mackenzie King would be on his government in the war, if a war came. So Rob was absolutely shaken. We were convinced ourselves, had been for some time, after Hitler had mm-hmm. started murdering everybody, we were convinced that it was coming. The war was coming in some form or other. We didn't know when it was coming nor what its nature would be. We didn't know how diverse it would be. But we were convinced, and we had to be ready. That's hence the reason we struggled so hard to get our flying clubs out and to set up our auxiliary squadrons for whom we could get supplies. But we couldn't get supplies for ourselves, and we got very, very little for ourselves until the war broke out.
Yeah. Now, who else was in privy to this? There was yourself, there was Rob. Who else was the driving force in this circle?
I mustn't take too much credit. I was the director of training for Canada. Mm-hmm. And I had some responsibility in that field. There were a number. Croyle himself, as the chief of the air staff, he was more for it than against it. He was somewhat ambivalent, and he didn't like taking a stand anyway. Now, there are several that were directly against it, didn't want it at all.
Who were they, sir?
Well, the one man would be, we called him Gus the Guzzler. And so you can imagine who Gus the Guzzler was. You know who was chiefly against it.
Who's Gus the Guzzler?
The poor guy drank himself pretty well to death and has gone out and wherever he's going. He's gone to.
Okay, and what was his name?
Well, Gus.
Gus who? You're not. Was his last name Gus? Or?
No. That's his.
His nickname or first name?
Nickname.
Nickname, okay. Well, who was.
It'll come out.
It'll come out.
I'll tell you in here later on. But he was the one that was against it. He wouldn't give Rob. I wanted a place for Rob. Was there all that stayed all that summer? Tried to get the thing going in Canada 37. Didn't go back till autumn. Late autumn. He had no office, no place except he had no office in our headquarters. So I had a very large office, and I simply had them bring him another desk and a chair and a bookcase and whatever he needed, and set him up in the corner of my office. Gave him a place to sit down, hang up his hat, and go to work and do his paperwork. And the guzzler didn't like that at all. He thought that was very unfair.
Tell me who Guz the Guzzler is.
You'll find out.
No, tell me now. We must know it now.
Oh.
If you're going to tell us the name later, tell it to us now.
I don't think so. You don't want that at this time. I'll tell you off the record. Go ahead.
You got to tell us on the record so someone knows what we're talking about.
Well, anyone that knows the Air Force history in the world will know about Guz the Guzzler. And he doesn't know
it. Okay, we'll leave that for research or somebody else. Okay, back to 1930. You're at the staff college. You have Tedder. Rob and others working, doing strategic viewpoints, as Dr. Douglas put it. Besides strategy, were you learning the staff work, as in the sense of a staff college, how to be proper administrators?
Oh, we got the whole bag of tricks. You got the whole bag of tricks. Administration, organization. In summary, you were given a job of work to do, set up a force to go to any part of the world at that time, and straight away your supplies will be your most important thing. So you had to have be able to organize it, plan it, set up the administrative arrangements, and make the whole thing tick. That would be the job. You'd be organized into teams. And given jobs work to do. Well, the thing that defeated us a good deal, but they wanted to see what you do anyway. They put us on a job like that in India. Well, now, few of us had been to India, some had. But the team that was lucky enough to have someone who'd been to India, you started taking a force out to India, landed. And where do you land it? And how do you get across the mountains up into Afghanistan and Kabul and various other places? I got a lot of red ink put over my papers because I'd never been there. And coming back to the one in the Eastern Mediterranean after the Dardanelles, that was a tremendous fiasco in the long run. And when we were fighting that out on the floor of the house, at the floor of the common, the staff college, that was one of the analyzing the whole deal. We studied the whole campaign. And I got quite a bit of red ink on one of my papers, chiefly on this ground. They were trying to teach, it wasn't Tedder, but there was another officer in there who was very keen on dotting the I's and crossing the T's and being so particular and always keeping a good diary, Now, who was the officer there that was in command, Sir something or other, he kept a beautiful diary, and he sold his diaries. He was the chief push, and they used it all the time. So now, in the middle of this great battle of the Dardanelles, you give me the chief man's name, but anyway, he kept a beautiful diary. And they threw all that ass. And I just got my paper back that morning on the Dardanelles, and Churchill was down to listen to this debate, because he was the one
who
spoke. And he was the kingpin. And about 11:30 that morning, I was feeling pretty low about all the red ink that they'd spread over my paper. And I got up and I said, well, if Sir, what the devil his name was, if he'd spent a little more time in practicing the art of fighting instead of the art of writing, perhaps the battle of the Dardanelles could have been different. Commandant got up and said, that's unfair. Dismissed for 20 minutes. So going down the hall, we came to the little boy's room, going past it, and Churchill came in too, and he said, you're a little bit rough on them this morning, Canada. You're a little bit rough on your bosses this morning.
So you met the great man himself, Churchill, eh?
Oh, he came down twice. He'd been knocked down by a taxi cab in New York that year.
That's right, yeah.
And he just got back on canes. But he liked his brandy and soda just the same. He said, you're a little bit rough on this morning, Canada. You're a little bit rough on him this morning. He's chuckling away. He spent a little more time in practicing the art of fighting and a little less in the art of writing. However, you still had to practice the art of writing.
No.
I wanted to give you the information of that thing, information on the existing civil and military factors. That would be putting them together.
Mm-hmm.
Will, in every situation, determine the type, the extent, and the coordination of sea, land, and air power. So that is the great idea of the Staff College, to know when to use your power and how to use it. And putting it together. So,
well, if we look at question 9, it deals specifically with the private flying clubs. Question 9 of Dr. Douglas's questionnaire.
Yes, yes.
And I'll read the question if I can. What was your impression of the private flying clubs, of their real purpose and effectiveness? Please include as much as you can about your knowledge of their origin and your opinion of their value both before the war, in the period between September 33 and the beginning of the BCATP training, and from then until December 1942, when the training, well, we'll hold off on the December part. If we can just get that first half part of that question.
Well, I put it this way. The Canadian Flying Clubs, in my book, were the primary ace in the army of the RCF in providing a strong and useful civilian air support in Canada, from the extent from Vancouver to Halifax between 1920 and 1944. For example, all club flying instructors had to be trained to a high standard, I mentioned that, and were categorized A1, A2, B1, B2, and so on. And now, again, the club mechanics are required to look after these machines, attend them and mend them. They were expensive aircraft, and they had to be looked after. And in the clubs, they demanded comparable training to your flying instructors and so on. Now, there was only one organization in Canada, one group that could possibly touch it and handle them as the Air Force. And the government, had the organization of the administrative procedures to meet the rules of safety and the whole bag of tricks. The government promptly handed it over to the Air Force at no cost to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So there was another job that we were doing, singing for their suppers, I've told you again and again. So again, in that way, we did see to something of the nature of a sound civil base, because these people were civil. They were business people, and lawyers, everything under the sun.
And they could get the money.
We could get some money for them.
Okay, it's all relative, though. But
they could get some money, and we could get some money for them, and we could train them and do all of these things. But they all became most useful parts immediately war broke out. And they all fitted in very well, because, however badly we did our work, the house would be very good if the work had been too bad. The better we did our job, the better our house would stand
mm-hmm.
when the storm came upon us.
Fair enough. You continue on in Staff College. You said you went to Germany in Europe.
Yeah.
What, to visit old ground or
reminisce
or as an observer?
Well, in the Staff College we had semesters, if you like. A short one. There were three major terms. The winter term, the spring and summer term, and then there was a break, and then the autumn term. Now, the early break between the spring and it was only about a week or 10 days, just a breather. The summer one, you had a longer one, and you were supposed to do a job of traveling to another continent and to do a useful job of work. And then you'd come back and record it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the copy of my job in there, and I went around Europe. I had a small English car, put it on a channel steamer, took it over to Europe, went around the battlefields of World War I, back to Cologne and Wickendorf, where I'd been stationed up
mm-hmm.
in Germany, and then down up the Rhine, not down the Rhine, up the Rhine, with the way the river flowed, down the Rhine on the map, to Baden-Baden and then across the Black Forest into Germany to Lake Constance, and they call it the Bodensee.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I told you the Zepps were, and also where the Germans had put their factories across into Switzerland to build their flying boats, and they had some military aircraft over there that they were building for South America.
Now this would be Weimar Germany as opposed to Nazi Germany.
They had brains and ability, and they're great workers.
What we're getting at, though, is that it wasn't strictly the Nazis that were doing this.
The Nazis weren't there yet.
That's right.
But
mm-hmm.
if Hindenburg had only lived a little longer, it never would have happened anyway. He was a very fine, able man.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went on to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Across the Alps, I drove over the Alps, drove my little car over the Alps, and I had to back it up the steeper trail to where Hannibal had taken his elephants. And it was just still about the Hannibal, that sort of track that we went over at that time.
It was still an elephant track, eh?
Yes, and I had to back it up the final peak. My car, because you see the
gravity tank?
The power of your engine. It's all climbing this thing up, but you see your reverse is the strongest gear you had. So I took my wife down about 200 yards and backed it up and put out a couple of the bags, and she sat on the bags and I backed it up the steep, and went right over to the Aldberg Pass into Italy, and down into Italy, and I toured around Italy, went to they had aircraft civil factories there. The flying boats you mentioned that came around the world was
mm-hmm.
built up from Genoa. There were another lot in over the Trieste and the other side. But we also went into Venice, but that was just for our own en route both ways.
Now, when you were there, I'm trying to think. was there any appreciations done of possible enemies for, say, the Empire while at the staff college? Was it assumed that Germany and Italy were going to be the bad guys, or was Russia on the
horizon? Mussolini was a bad guy already by that time. Okay. But there was no alliance that we knew about between Mussolini and Germany in 1930.
Well, it wasn't there in 30, but what I'm saying is, who were your probable enemies or the ones to watch for? And was there any appreciations done at this time?
There were appreciations done on a good number, but there were only appreciations of possible affairs, but not necessarily probable. We weren't convinced that World War II was going to come at that time. It was by the mid-30s. This is 1930 we're talking about.
Yes.
But it was only about the 1935, 36 that we became reasonably sure that that was going to be it.
Okay, fair enough.
Because there was no definite feeling that in 30. Mind you, everybody speculated.
Certainly.
But it's only speculation.
It's purely speculation. Now, I'm wondering how you were doing financially at this point, in the sense of, I'm not talking about personal monies or anything, but salary with the Air Force, was it a good enough living?
Well, in 1930, the Hungry 30s. And,
this is what I'm getting at, too. And you had your wife over there, too, and motor cruises weren't done.
And there were various, yes, furthermore, there were various things that you wanted to do. First of all, you talked about, it's very important that your wife see what the world is all about. If she's going to be married to someone in the military, she should know what she had to face. And the staff college training was just as important for her in the things that she could do. For example, the meeting all of the important people. The
social obligations.
Well, there are social obligations, but beyond that too, she attended all the functions that whether they were flying or whatever, and it is tremendously important. And go on even further to social, the staff officers at the staff college were invited to be presented at Buckingham Palace, and that was very important. And the whole of the mall, about 2 miles, is clogged with motor cars and people the night of the presentation. So it was a good education, a very good education.
What was London like during this time for you?
Oh, it's still London, very much London. It wasn't wartime London, but it was vastly better than it is now with what's in there now, so I can tell you. Vastly better. And not, it hadn't lost its head with regard to prices either. Now you pay a fantastic price for nothing.
I know. I was there last summer.
You know. But no, London was good. And it always had been up until very recently. Even after War II, it was very good for me.
I guess it was an exciting time, though. I'm thinking of the 30s, the Empire.
Well, exciting is a good word, but it is a good solid time. There was a lot of good thinking going on, solid thinking going on. It wasn't a period of rot by any means.
Okay, fair enough. You returned from the staff college in 31?
Yes, into 31.
31, the Depression is really into full swing.
Pinching. It was pinching before, but it was pinching harder. That's about the time they cut us in half.
Well, the cut comes in 1932. You have a new government. Was there any... You have a new government in 30. Looked at good times with Bennett and the Conservatives?
The government came in and actually in about December... December... thereabouts, anyway.
Yeah.
The R.B. Bennett government was in power when I came back in 31. I remember that very well indeed.
Was there any look towards a better time, say, after Mackenzie King, towards for the Air Force when Bennett first came in, or was the Depression all-consuming?
I think the Depression had overtaken the world, and there were many people up until the great crash came in September 29, and I remember the people jumping out of the windows in New York, and there were any number of our people in the Air Force were gambling like fury on the stock market, and some of them lost their shirts.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The gambling can be a little bit beyond their depth, and pretty hard to pay off. Not too many, but a few.
Mm-hmm. You get back in 31, I guess the talk then would be the great cut that's coming for 32, when you're going to be cut back $244,000.
Yeah, well,
That was in civil aviation, I'm sorry, $244,000 out of civil aviation.
Well, I was the director, they made me the director of civil government air operations as soon as I came back, and I was on that job for 2 years.
So from 31 to 33, you were the director of civil?
CJAL, civil government air operations.
Promoted at this time
for the
squadron leader?
Squadron leader.
Now, as head of civil aviation, 31, you were voted.
We weren't the head. I was the director.
Director.
I was the director. I had to report to a head.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but the point is that in 31, $2.5 million was voted by the Commons for civil aviation, and in 32, that was cut back by $244,000. Do you recall?
I recall it very well indeed. But they didn't. They cut back our money, but they increased our work. We just worked longer hours.
Austerity program.
We just worked longer hours, and we not only cut us back. They never cut back on our fuel load because we were working for other government, civil government departments, and they, if they wanted us to do the work, they had to
cough up with the bucks.
They had to find the fuel and put it. And frequently, they put it in. So if they wanted us to do the work, lay down the fuel or else. No work, no gasoline for the engine, no work.
Mm.
And they had to lay it down all over the North of Canada. Actually, we increased our flying hours when they cut our flying and cut our estimates down, but they just doubled our work, and it worked out pretty well. It worked harder.
What was it like? Now you were based in Ottawa.
Yes.
What was it like when the axe fell, if you will?
It was very serious.